Okay, last unit. Three more chapters. The first of these that we're looking at right now is actually, I forget the title of it.
It's called Meiosis and Sexual Life
Cycles. Right, Meiosis and Sexual Life Cycles. As I've said, it's about DNA because we've been in DNA mode since the last unit and will continue to be for the rest of the term. But this one is actually positioned before the ones we just looked at in the last unit. This is, I think, in this text, in the textbook it's from. I think it's chapter 13. So the book, the authors wanted you to learn this stuff first and then the stuff we just got tested on later. There's arguments both ways, but hopefully the way we did it will make this seem even easier. But when we're looking at these two organisms here in these photographs, the hydra and the redwood, there are some things that they have in common, of course, and there are some things that are different. What do they have in common? Any? Yeah, yeah, that's definitely true. Even more specifically. No, that's not true. That's actually a difference. Another one, more specifically than living organisms, you think about the dichotomy of life, right? The dichotomy of cell types. Go ahead. No, this is not a plant. This is a hydra, which is a protist, but they are both eukaryotes. Prokaryotes, of course, which aren't shown here, are the other half of that dichotomy. These share the fact that they are eukaryotes. And we're used to thinking of large eukaryotes because we are large eukaryotes, so we tend to think of animals and plants. Fungi are also large, and some algae are very large as well. But those are not the only eukaryotes. There are also microscopically small or unicellular eukaryotes. Hydra is an example of that. And like prokaryotes, all of which are asexual, there are also some eukaryotes that are asexual. So that's the big difference here between these two, even though they're both eukaryotes. One of them, the hydra, is asexual, and the redwood is sexual. So don't think that all eukaryotes are sexual, even though most are. But what is the fundamental difference between these opposites, asexual and sexual? Well, we'll get a little bit deeper into it later, but generally speaking, a sexual species reproduces, the reproduction that happens in a sexual species involves two organisms, two individuals, two parents, in other words, that give rise to an offspring. Whereas asexual reproduction involves only one parent giving rise to offspring. Now, when asexual reproduction occurs, like it occurs in the hydra, the offspring that are produced, however many that is, are genetically identical to the parent, to that single parent. So that is a really important difference between asexual and sexual reproduction. That's the one that really matters evolutionarily. Asexual reproduction produces genetically identical offspring. Not only genetically identical to each other, but genetically identical to the parent. Whereas sexual reproduction never produces offspring that are identical to the parent. And that's because sex has the effect of amplifying genetic variation. Now, more about that in a minute, but back to this difference, this kind of two ways of approaching reproduction, asexually and sexually. not right to say that one of them is correct and one of them is incorrect, or one of them is better and one of them is not as good. There are arguments for and against each of these two types of reproduction. What is a good argument for asexual reproduction? Why would a species want to produce offspring that are genetically identical to the parent? That's right. If you are already have very high fitness is how well adapted you are to your living conditions. If you're doing just fine, you have just the right traits, then why would you want to change anything, right? And if you are, now nothing has ever been perfectly adapted, but if you are perfectly adapted, then you wouldn't want to mix anything up, right? If it ain't broke, don't fix it. You would expect your offspring to have just as high fitness as you if you know that your offspring are going to be genetically identical to you. But what's the problem with that argument?
If it changes, the environment changes.
That's right. There's no such thing as an environment that never changes. So you are fit, maybe, but if the environment suddenly changes, your identical offspring are no longer going to be as fit as you. In fact, they might be not fit at all. So that's the whole argument for sex. It randomly shuffles the genetic deck, so you don't have any idea what you're going to get, good or bad. But, especially if you produce a lot of offspring, chances are, because of the variation in your offspring, that maybe one of them will be at least, if not better fit than you are. And when conditions change, as they're always going to, because the environment changes continuously, then sex can adjust for that changing environment and continue to produce offspring that are well adapted. That's why sex has been so successful. But just as easily as sex produces offspring that are better fit, actually more easily than that, it can produce offspring that aren't as fit. But natural selection selects against them, right? That's why they don't survive. Okay, well, let's go on to slide 2 and talk more about DNA. This colored cartoon that you see here on the left is really just a cartoon version of the real things you see on the right, specifically this number 1. But there are 23 pairs of chromosomes shown here, which should tell you that the chromosomes come from humans, right? Because we know that humans have 23 kinds of chromosomes, or at least I've said that a couple times in this course. The black background photograph that you see here is an example of what we call a karyotype. Same root as in eukaryote and prokaryote. A karyotype is a photographic image of all of the chromosomes in a specific species, or in an individual, I should say, not an entire species, an individual, with those chromosomes arranged. So the chromosomes don't pose for this photograph, obviously. You don't look at a cell and see them all nicely arranged like this. A photograph is taken of the actual cell, a photomicrograph through a microscope. And then in the old days, it was literal cut and paste. You would cut little pieces of the photograph out, find all the individual chromosomes, and match them together by size in pairs, and then arrange them by size from largest to smallest and put them on a background like this and then take a picture again. Nowadays we can electronically cut and paste, but we're still cutting and pasting because they never really look like this in the cell, right? They would be a jumble and you wouldn't see them as individual chromosomes at all if you weren't looking at a cell during the correct part of the cell cycle like we've talked about, right? So when during the cell cycle do you take the snapshot to make a karyotype? Right, metaphase, and that wasn't a guess, I'm sure. Why did you say metaphase? It is when they are all lined up, that's what describes it, but what else is true of metaphase compared to the rest?
I would just assume it's easiest to view.
It is easier to view them, that's one of the reasons, but it's also true that that is as small as they're ever going to be, as compact. Remember, it's chromatin at first. We don't call them chromosomes until they've condensed to the point that we see individual pieces. Well, those pieces get smaller and smaller and more distinct from each other as they go through the early stages of cell division until you finally get to metaphase. They not only line up then, but they're also as easy to distinguish from each other as they'll ever be because they're compact. Okay, now, we've talked about chromosomes before, and so it shouldn't surprise you that sister chromatids are labeled here. We've talked about that before, right? So what we see here as kind of an overall X shape in close-up, each one of these pairs is kind of X-shaped, but this is two separate chromosomes. So don't think of this as an X chromosome, which is a totally different thing. This is two separate chromosomes, and not only that, each of the individual chromosomes is a replicated chromosome, which should make sense, right? Because by the time you get to mitosis, replication, which occurs in the S phase of interphase, has already occurred. That's why there are two identical sister chromatids making up that one replicated chromosome. But then there's another replicated chromosome right beside it in this cartoon, also made up of two identical sister chromatids. And that replicated chromosome is of the same type. It's also, in this case, a number one chromosome because it's the biggest one in the cell. So these are two number one chromosomes based on their size. Each of them is already replicated, but they are not genetically identical to each other. They're just the same type of chromosome. The sister chromatids in each chromosome are identical to each other, but this chromatid and this chromatid are not identical because they're on different chromosomes. Now, why is it, first of all, that we have two number ones and two number twos and two number threes? Which you'll see in any sexual species. It won't necessarily be that they have 23. That number depends on the species. But why is it that we have two of each kind of chromosome? No, they do replicate, and they have replicated individually already. But that's not why we have two of them. But if we only had one number one, it would still undergo replication and be made up of two sister chromatids. Yeah, we're sexual. Sexual species have a chromosome from each of its two parents. Right? So one number one came from the father, one number one came from the mother. And that's also why they are not identical to each other. Because the mother and the father were not genetically identical. Okay? So, that explains why we have two of every type of chromosome. Sex explains that, in other words. One word we haven't talked about up until now is the word homologous. These two chromosomes that are in close-up here are considered to be homologous to each other, and they therefore make up a homologous pair. Homologous just means they're of the same type. They're both number ones, but there are two homologous number twos, two homologous number threes, and so on. All right? Now, we didn't talk about this before because even though they're there in a cell at all times, two number ones, two number twos, and so on, the two number ones most of the time do not care where the other one is. Each number one is acting as its own chromosome. The other number one is somewhere. Okay, so it's only during something we care about in this chapter that the two homologs, as they're called, that make up a homologous pair, will come together, will find each other and come together. That's only during meiosis that happens. Okay, so, well, let me go on to the next picture to make this next point. Slide 3 now. I need to make sure you understand fully, because this is a sticking point often with students, some important definitions. Need to know that, well, what I mean by ploidy. Have you seen this word before? Let me use something other than white. That's still gray. Ploidy is... Well, let me tell you what ploidy isn't, because a lot of people get this wrong. Ploidy is not how many chromosomes are in a cell. Ploidy has to do with chromosomes, but it is not the number of chromosomes. It's also not how many types of chromosomes there are. All right? The number of types of chromosomes has its own definition, which is symbolized as N. Any given cell, or any given species, I should say, has an N associated with it. N simply is how many types of chromosomes that species has. And it just depends on the species. So N equals 23 for humans, because we have 23 different kinds of chromosomes. Not necessarily 23 total chromosomes, as we saw in that karyotype in the previous slide. Right, that previous slide had 46 chromosomes overall. But there are 23 kinds of chromosomes, number 1 through 23, right? There were two of each of those, so that's why there were 46 total. But N means how many different kinds of chromosomes. Just depends on species. Corn has like 40. Other things have fewer than we do. We have 23. Okay, and that's not ploidy. That's what a lot of people confuse with ploidy. Ploidy, on the other hand, refers to how many of each type of chromosomes are in a cell. And ploidy is the general word. So we use specific words for the specific cases. If a cell has only one of each type of chromosome, in other words, if it has one of each of these N and so therefore has N total, then that is a haploid cell. The condition would be haploidy. On the other hand, if there are two of every chromosome type, which means there would be 2N total, then that's a diploid cell. So, do you see the difference between ploidy and N? Now, everyone always says yes here, but then I find that they don't really actually understand it. Pay attention to this very simple cartoon case of whatever fictitious species this is. What is the N of this cell? It is 3, and you could have cheated just by dividing 6 by 2, right? Just to figure out what N is. But just look at the picture. You don't even have to look at any of the words. We can see that there are 3 types of chromosomes here. Large, medium, and small. All right? But there are 2 of each of them, right? So this is a diploid cell. Because there's 2 large, 2 medium, 2 small. And that's why any diploid cell can be symbolized as 2n, a 2n cell. Whatever n is, you're going to have 2 times n total cells if it's a diploid cell. You're going to have exactly n chromosomes if it's a haploid cell. All right? So not only is this a diploid cell, but every one of these chromosomes is replicated, which is why every one of them is made up of 2 identical sister chromatids that are still connected together. And where, what is the place where they are connected together called? The centromere. Not the centrosome. Centromere. There's confusing terminology, remember? Chromatids, separate from chromatin. It all gets confusing. But yeah, centromere is the connection point between 2 sister chromatids that are identical to each other because it's the product of replication that happened back in the S phase. Okay. Now, notice that these replicated chromosomes are just kind of randomly spread out in the cell here. In other words, even though there are homologous pairs, 2 number ones, 2 number twos, and 2 number threes, they don't care what the other is doing. They're at their own places, right? So this is what I was talking about earlier. As this cell proceeds through meiosis, the 2 number ones are going to find each other and come together, and the 2 number twos and the 2 number threes. But that hasn't happened yet. Okay. The red and the blue, by the way, denote parental origin. So by using the key here, you can see that the red means that came from the mother. It's maternal origin. And the blue ones came from the father. Okay, now let's talk about slide 4, which has to do with sexual life cycles. This one uses humans as an example, but actually this would be true of all animals, not just humans. Actually, even before we get to that, let me say something even more general, which would apply to all sexual species, not just animals. And so I haven't really gotten to the picture yet. Let me say, though, that every sexual species, but only the sexual species, all sexual species undergo a generation-to-generation alternation between 2 important biological processes, which are the ones shown in the boxes here, fertilization and meiosis. Now, what is fertilization? Well, before we get to that, let me just say what I meant by alternation is that I'm not talking about within an individual. I'm saying from one generation to the next generation, and so on. It goes back and forth between fertilization and meiosis, and then fertilization again, then meiosis again, and so on. So that's what I meant by alternation, generation to generation. But what is fertilization?
The union of 2 uniformly haploid genes to produce 1 diploid zygote.
Usually, yes. Fertilization is the hallmark of sex. It's really what defines a sexual species. So a species is not sexual unless fertilization is happening somewhere in the life cycle. All right, now there's all kinds of ways that you can get to fertilization. For instance, we animals mate to do that. Not all sexual species mate. Trees can't do this because they're planted in the ground, right? So they don't mate, but they are just as sexual as we are. So all the other things that we consider to be part of sex really are just fluff. What really makes it sex is fertilization. And fertilization is, as you said, a union or a fusion of 2 different cells into 1 cell, which is kind of the opposite of cell theory, right? Cell theory says that 1 cell splits into 2 new cells. In fertilization, you have 2 cells fusing into 1. And those cells are sex cells, which in a unisex usage are called gametes. Gamete is just another word for sex cell, and it's the unisex term, meaning it doesn't tell you which version. There are two gametes in each sexual species, a male version and a female version. So sperm are male gametes for us humans. Eggs or ova are female gametes. But if fertilization does not take place unless the two different kinds of gametes in the species fuse into one cell. And that one cell has a special name that results if it goes well, and which is a zygote. All right? That's how every one of you officially began. Now, really, you are just a continuation of nearly 4 billion years of cells reproducing. It's been unbroken since that first successful lineage that we all came from. For that whole almost 4 billion years to your life, that has been going on unbroken. You're just the latest collection of cells. But if you want to think of yourself as an individual, which is fine if you want to, then you really officially started as a zygote. Because that before that, you didn't exist. Your father had sperm, your mother had eggs, you didn't exist yet. You start out as a unicellular organism called a zygote. And then after multiple cell divisions, meiosis and cytokinesis, you became a multicellular individual that you know yourself as now. But when two gametes fuse in fertilization, that's what fertilization is, not only does the cytoplasm join, but the two nuclei also do. Each gamete has its own nucleus before fertilization. It's a normal cell in that respect. It has a nucleus, as you'd expect for a eukaryotic cell. And each one has its own set of chromosomes. A full set, right? So when those two unite, those two gametes unite to form the zygote now has twice as many chromosomes as either gamete did. Right? Which, in terms of ploidy, means fertilization results in a doubling of the ploidy. Right? Because you have a chromosome of each type from the sperm, plus you have a chromosome of each type from the egg. Therefore, you have doubled the ploidy. Okay, well, fertilization, you know, by bringing DNA together from two different organisms, that is the essence for the success of sex, because that's what explains why offspring are not identical to their parents. Right? It makes new versions of organisms, genetically speaking. That's why it evolved, because that was successful for reasons I discussed earlier. But there's a problem with that. If fertilization were only the only thing that occurs each generation in a sexual species, that means the ploidy would continue to double every generation. So the first offspring would have diploid cells, and then the next their children would have tetraploid cells, because their already diploid gametes would get together to form a tetraploid 4N zygote, right? And then their grandchildren would be octuploid, and so on. It would double every generation, because fertilization always doubles it. Well, that would get out of hand very quickly. And it's already amazing that we can fit so much DNA into an even tinier nucleus than the already microscopic cell that nucleus is part of. If you keep doubling it, obviously you're going to run out of room very quickly. So the species would die off almost immediately, just in a few generations, if that happened. That's why in every sexual species, which by virtue of being sexual have to have fertilization, there also has to be a counteracting process, meaning a process that counteracts the doubling of the ploidy that fertilization accomplishes. To undo that means to cut the ploidy in half, right? That's the inverse of doubling, is to cut it in half. And that's exactly what meiosis is. That's why meiosis evolved. Meiosis cuts the ploidy in half. So when you double it in fertilization, making a diploid offspring, and then those offspring make their own gametes for the next generation, those gametes are produced by meiosis, which will cut the ploidy in half again. That gets you to haploid. Just one of each chromosome, right? Those haploid gametes will then merge together in the next generation, fertilization. That's going to double it, but it's going to double it back to diploid only. And then meiosis in the next generation is going to bring it back to haploid, and then diploid in the next generation, and so on. That's the alternation. Without meiosis, there would be a doubling every generation, and it couldn't possibly work. All right, so that is really why we have meiosis, and that's why only sexual species have meiosis. Now, any questions on that before I go on? Let me then go to 5 and look at very similar life cycles. Like I said before, the one that used us as an example in slide 4 really is just a specific example of the animal one that we see here. So this really is exactly the same thing that we just saw, only it's labeled a little bit differently. But we also have other major groups of sexual species, plants and fungi. Animals, plants, and fungi are three major multicellular groups of eukaryotes. Notice that every one of these, and this is something I already said before, every one of these features meiosis and fertilization, because that's true of all sexual species. So since there is meiosis and fertilization in every sexual life cycle, that means every sexual life cycle, whatever the species is, features part of that cycle that is haploid and part of that cycle that's diploid. That's why we have an N label, which is the cyan part, and a 2N part, which is the diploid part, represented by the rose-colored part of the cycle. Okay? So that is true for all. Now let's talk about the differences in these three life cycles. We'll talk about animals first, even though we've already talked about it. We're used to being animals, so it makes sense to us. In animals, individuals are diploid. An adult version of the animal is a diploid multicellular organism, just like us. Those adult diploid organisms, those animals, are then able to produce gametes via meiosis, and those gametes are haploid. But gametes are also unicellular. And so in animals, there is no multicellular haploid stage. It's only unicellular. A sperm or an egg, whichever one you want to consider, a gamete of an animal, is never going to be multicellular. By far, the vast majority just die as gametes that are unused. They never get past unicellular stage. For the ones that are lucky enough to be involved in fertilization, then they're no longer haploid, right? The zygote, by definition, is diploid in that case. So it only is ever unicellular during the haploid stage of animals. Let's go to C, which is the kind of the opposite. Most fungi are kind of the opposite of animals. An adult fungus that you might see as a mushroom, for instance, lives its life as a haploid multicellular organism. So the cells that make up its body are haploid cells, not diploid like ours are. And so when it comes time for that already haploid multicellular fungus to make its gametes, it doesn't do so by meiosis. It doesn't make any sense for a haploid cell to undergo meiosis, because meiosis halves the ploidy, right? If you're already haploid, it doesn't make sense to cut it in half again. You only have one of each kind of chromosome. So they're already haploid, the cells of their body. Therefore, they make their reproductive cells just by mitosis. Keeps them haploid that way, right? Because mitosis does not change the ploidy. It just makes copies. When those gametes, those haploid gametes, get together, just like for us, in fertilization, that, of course, produces a diploid zygote, right? But unlike us, well, let me say again what happens in us. The diploid zygote that we animals start out as then becomes multicellular by mitosis. Not so in a typical fungus. That zygote that results, while it's still just one cell, immediately enters meiosis to become haploid cells, because meiosis reduces the ploidy. And then those haploid cells individually undergo mitosis multiple times to become different individual haploid multicellular fungi. And then it repeats. So the what's opposite about that from our point of view is that their diploid stage is unicellular only. Our haploid stage is unicellular. Their haploid stage is multicellular. Our diploid stage is multicellular. You see the difference there? Well, plants are a special case that's in the middle. In plants, you have multicellularity in both stages, both the haploid and the diploid stages, which means for the same species, there are two different versions. There's a multicellular haploid plant of that species, and there's a multicellular diploid plant of that species. And notice they have different names. The sporophyte here, what phyte here means plant. So sporophyte literally means spore-bearing plant. That's the name for the diploid plant, which is the one that we're used to looking at. There's also, though, a gametophyte stage, the gamete-producing plant, that for most plants we don't actually see ever because it lives inside the sporophyte, but it still is a multicellular individual in its own right. Okay? And so that's given a special name in plants. It's called alternation of generations. Now, don't be confusing this word alternation. Alternation of generations is not referring to what I used before the word alternation for. Every sexual species alternates between fertilization and meiosis. That's not what I'm talking about here. Alternation of generations refers to the specific case in plants in which there is multicellularity in both the haploid and the diploid stages, not just one. Okay. Any questions on those definitions? Let's go to six then. Now let's put these definitions to use and start talking about meiosis. This is the simplest case. Just to make things easiest to understand, what is the end of the cell we see at the top here?
One.
Yes, n equals 1, which is why it's the simplest case. It's 1 because there's only one kind of chromosome here, right? There's only one size. And what about the ploidy? It's diploid. Because there are two of that type of chromosome, right? That's the difference. Ploidy is how many of each kind of chromosome you have. N is how many kinds of chromosomes you have. And that's what a lot of people confuse. So get that straight. All right? There's only one kind here. There's no big and small. There's only one size. There's two of them, though, so it's a diploid cell. And therefore, like all diploid cells, you would symbolize that as 2N. But in this case, N equals 1, so their total number of chromosomes is 2 times 1, or 2. All right. For us, if this were a human cell, how many overall chromosomes would there be? Because N equals 23 for humans. And a diploid cell in human, therefore, has 2 times 23, 2N, chromosomes total, which is 46. Okay, now, back to this fictitious one with an N of 1. This top picture is a lie, not only because it's a cartoon, but because of something I've told you before in similar pictures. It's a lie because we wouldn't see these chromosomes as chromosomes yet. Why is that? What kind of chromosomes are these on the top? Unreplicated. Right. They haven't replicated yet. And remember that they don't start being called chromosomes until they condense, which is much later than replicating. So this is showing you unreplicated chromosomes as compact chromosomes just so you can see them, separate from the tangle of spaghetti that they really would be at this point in the cell cycle. It would really just be chromatin at this point, right? Before S phase. Okay, then you get to the S phase. And even though this is a lie also for the same reason, after the S phase you now have twice as much DNA. But you still have the same number of chromosomes. And that's really just because of a kind of a word game we play. There's twice as much DNA, but after the S phase, it's doubled because of replication, right? And replication means that each chromosome is now a replicated chromosome. But we consider a one replicated chromosome still to be one chromosome. So we started with 2 overall chromosomes, one type, but 2 overall chromosomes. We still have 2 chromosomes after replication. It's just that we've gone from 2 unreplicated chromosomes to 2 replicated chromosomes. And that's why I say it's kind of a word game, because 2 replicated chromosomes, in this case of this species, is enough for 2 separate cells, right? It's enough DNA for 2 cells. But when they're still held together in that same cell, before that cell division takes place, we consider them to be individual replicated chromosomes when they're still stuck together. Okay. That's really not new information. We've talked about that before when we studied mitosis. Now we get to meiosis. And there are obviously differences between meiosis and mitosis, but there are also similarities. One similarity is that both mitosis and meiosis are divisions of the nucleus. Remember, that's the definition I gave you for mitosis, right? It's not cell division, it is just part of cell division. Mitosis is division of the nucleus only, whereas cytokinesis is division of the cytoplasm. Well, meiosis is another version of nuclear division. It's also division of the nucleus. But it happens only in special cases, only for certain types of cells. So let me tell you in your own body about the two types of cells that make you up. There are, well, there's all kinds of categories of cells, of course, but there's two major categories from the standpoint of what's important in today. And those are somatic cells and germline cells. Somatic is a word that means of the body. Soma means body. Same root as in, for instance, chromosome, which means colorful body. But somatic means of the body. Now, obviously, all of your cells, even the germline cells, are part of your body, so it's kind of a misnomer. But the reason that was used is because the germline cells are only about your own body. And also, they happen to make up almost your entire body. You have how many cells, roughly? 100 trillion that you call your own, and many more times that bacteria that you're carrying around. But your 100 trillion are your own cells, meaning they feature your own DNA. Okay? Almost all of those are somatic cells. Germline cells is a tiny, tiny minority of cells, a very small population in your overall cells. And they occur only in your gonads, which are the ovaries if you're a female and the testes if you're a male. Their germline cells are not just about your own body. Your germline cells are about the next generation if you allow it that to happen. Okay, so it's not just about your own body. That's why they were named this. There's important differences, but first let me say something that's similar. Both somatic cells and germline cells are diploid. So that's a... Don't think that somatic cells are diploid and germline cells are haploid. That's not true. Now to the important difference. A somatic cell can undergo only mitosis as part of its cell division. It's either not going to divide at all, or it's going to undergo mitosis to divide. And cytokinesis, obviously. All right. A germline cell, on the other hand, undergoes mitosis and meiosis. And it undergoes mitosis first. Now, meiosis, as we've already discussed, reduces or halves the ploidy, cuts it in half, right? That means that germline cells that undergo meiosis are going to make cells that are haploid. But those haploid cells that are produced by meiosis from germline cells are not called germline cells anymore. Those are gametes. Okay? Now back to this notion of mitosis and meiosis both. You could have germline cells just undergo meiosis and cytokinesis and skip the mitosis. That would produce gametes, because that's what meiosis can do, right? What would be the problem with doing that? And I have to admit, this is a difficult question probably for you. But just seeing if anyone can get this. What would be the problem with germline cells, which is this tiny minority of your cells, undergoing only mitosis to produce gametes and skipping the mitosis step? Exactly. You would run out of germline cells quickly because you have a tiny number of them, right? A cell that undergoes meiosis no longer exists, right? Instead, you have cells that it turns into. So you have precious few of these things. If you lost them every time one of them went into meiosis, you would run out quickly. That's why first a germline cell will undergo mitosis, which produces two identical replacements of that original, right? The original germline cell no longer exists, but now you have two germline cells. One of them will just stick around and replace the one that you lost. The other one will go into meiosis and become gametes. And that way you maintain this very small population of germline cells through your lifetime. Or through a big part of your lifetime, at least. That all makes sense? Okay, so they're both diploid. Somatic cells are diploid cells that, if they reproduce themselves by cell division, will do so only by mitosis to produce just two identical copies of itself with the same ploidy. Mitosis always maintains ploidy because it makes genetically identical copies of the cell that enters mitosis. Right? That's why, for instance, your skin cells are always busy doing this, because you lose hundreds of millions of skin cells every day. You know, just the wind blowing on you is going to lose skin cells from you. So you need to replace those so you won't run out. Somatic cells do that by mitosis. Red blood cells as well. All your cells do this, except neurons, for instance. Some neurons never do that. They stay as a neuron for your whole lifetime. But the germline cells are also diploid cells to begin with, right? They undergo mitosis to save their population, and then meiosis to produce the gametes, which are different from germline cells. The gametes are haploid, the germline cells are diploid. Okay? Now we can go on to the middle part of the slide 6, where meiosis is happening. One, we've already talked about one major difference between meiosis and mitosis, which is, whereas mitosis maintains ploidy, meiosis reduces ploidy. And that's really the important difference, because that's the whole reason to have meiosis. You have to reduce the ploidy to undo fertilization. But another important difference is that mitosis is a single division event. There's only one division in every instance of mitosis. And that's why, assuming cytokinesis also happens, after mitosis you start with one cell, you end up with two, because it's one division. Meiosis, on the other hand, features two rounds of division, two nuclear divisions, which means that you start with one cell, and if you go all the way through it, you end up with four cells. Two first, and then each of those two split. Four overall. All right? And since there are two nuclear divisions in meiosis, we give them Roman numerals. Overall, meiosis is split up into meiosis 1 and meiosis 2. Now, understanding meiosis is more difficult than understanding mitosis. So hopefully you have a solid grip on what happened in mitosis, because it helps to understand meiosis. That's why we went over mitosis first. Really important for you to understand is that the thing that happens that reduces the ploidy, or cuts it in half in meiosis, happens in meiosis 1, not in meiosis 2. The ploidy gets reduced in meiosis 1. Now, meiosis 1 and meiosis 2 are both kind of similar to mitosis in that they each feature their own substeps, even though you don't see that detail right here. Remember, we talked about prophase, prometaphase, metaphase, anaphase, telophase of mitosis. You have the same steps in meiosis 1, and you have those same steps in meiosis 2. Different things are happening, though, in meiosis 1 and meiosis 2, but they're split up into the same named substeps. Now, the one I want to focus on, though, substep, is metaphase. Well, two of them, metaphase and anaphase. Metaphase first, though. What do you know about metaphase? What defines it? No. Right, it's the lining up. That's in mitosis that we've already learned. In metaphase involves a lining up of things. Well, what is it in mitosis that lines up during metaphase? What kind of chromosomes? No. Unreplicated aren't even in meiosis, right? That's back in interphase. So it's replicated chromosomes that line up during metaphase. And more specifically, let me say that it's not just replicated chromosomes that line up, it's individual replicated chromosomes. Meaning that you have a replicated number one and another replicated number one, right? But they don't care where each other is. So, in a human, how many different things are lining up during metaphase of mitosis? Forty-six, because there are 46 total chromosomes, right? They all line up individually as their own replicated chromosomes. Does that make sense? You need to make that to make sense, because that's not what happens in metaphase of meiosis one. In metaphase of meiosis one, what line up at metaphase are not individual replicated chromosomes. Instead, what line up are pairs of replicated chromosomes, homologous pairs. Meaning that the pair of number ones is one unit that's lining up, and the pair of number twos, and the pair of number threes, and so on. So we said there are 46 things that line up during metaphase of mitosis for humans. In general, if you don't know the species, how many things line up in mitosis of metaphase? I mean, metaphase of mitosis.
Two N,
exactly. 2N. How many things line up during metaphase of meiosis 1? N. 23 for humans, right? You have a pair of number ones, that's one thing, a pair of number twos, and 23 different pairs overall. Okay? It's really important to understand that difference. For that same reason, or relatedly, not only do the different things line up in metaphase one of meiosis versus metaphase of mitosis, but then, because of that difference, different things separate during anaphase that comes next. So let's first go back to what you know better, mitosis. What is it that separate during anaphase of mitosis?
The homologs?
No. Well, we call them that eventually, but what actually separate from each other? Sister chromatids. Right? Remember that the thing lining up is an individual replicated chromosome, which is, by virtue of being replicated, consisting of two identical sister chromatids, right? And the two things that separate in the next step, in anaphase, are the two sister chromatids that are stuck together to make up that replicated chromosome to begin with. Right? They're held together at the centromere, and that's what splits apart. We talked about that in mitosis, right? Each one will go to its own pole and end up in its own cell. Okay, that's not what happens in anaphase 1 of meiosis. So just to refresh our memories, what is it that lines up during metaphase of meiosis 1? Not exactly. That's what lines up during metaphase of mitosis. Homologous pairs of replicated chromosomes line up during metaphase of meiosis. Now, there's another word you can use, by the way. You can call a homologous pair a homologous pair. That's one name that's fine. You can also call it a tetrad, which is a general word that means a four-piece thing, right? Tetra means four. The reason it makes sense to call a homologous pair of replicated chromosomes a tetrad is that since they're replicated, each of them already has two sister chromatids that make it up. So the pair of replicated chromosomes has four overall chromatids that it's made up of. That's why we call it a tetrad. Okay? Other books might call it a bivalent. They all mean the same thing. But a tetrad and a pair of homologous chromosomes means the same thing. Okay, so that's what's lining up. N tetrads are lining up, however many N is, 23 for humans. What is it that then separate during anaphase? No. No. That happens in mitosis. The members of the pair separate. So the two homologs separate from each other. And notice that they're replicated to begin with, right? You have a replicated number one and another replicated number one making up the homologous number one pair. Each of those homologs separates from the other. But notice that that doesn't separate any chromatids, right? Any sister chromatids. Because as the one number one goes its way, it still is made up of two sister chromatids. It's still a replicated chromosome. And so is the other number one that's going to end up in a different cell. Okay? Now this is exactly why what I said before is true, that in meiosis one, the ploidy gets reduced. Because think about this. You have a cell, first of all, with two number ones. Now you're going to have, after the division, the first division, you're going to have a cell with just one of the two number ones, whether it's the father's or the mother's, it's random, and another cell with just one number one, right? It's also going to have just one number two and just one number everything through 23. So those are already haploid cells. Do you see that? And the goal, in a sense, of meiosis is to produce haploid cells, because that undoes the doubling of the ploidy that fertilization accomplishes. But you can't be done there, right? Because if you stopped there, yes, you would have haploid cells, but they would still have twice as much DNA as they need to be one cell. Right? Just like a cell that went through the S phase but skipped mitosis, right? It's a cell that has two cells worth of DNA, but it's still just one cell. And how do you solve that in mitosis? By splitting the two sister chromatids apart to make two cells, each with just enough DNA for one cell. Well, after the two homologs split, which are still replicated, you have cells that, yes, are haploid, but still have double the amount of DNA to be just one cell. And that's why you need a process just like mitosis to get rid of that, to make double the cells and dole out that DNA evenly. That's exactly what meiosis II is. And meiosis II really is just like mitosis because it accomplishes the same thing. Okay? So let's make sense of this in the cartoon now. You already have replication. That's why you have a 2N cell here with two replicated chromosomes at this point. Now it enters meiosis. Meiosis 1 first, obviously. And there's only one thing to line up here, not two. If this were mitosis, each of these replicated chromosomes would be lining up individually. Right? Two end things line up. In meiosis, these make up one tetrad. So that one thing lines up. They're already lined up right here in this picture. This would be the metaphase plate, right between the two homologs. You see that? And when they split, one homolog goes to one cell, the other one goes to the other cell. Those are already haploid. Right? These are N cells. This was a 2N cell. But these already haploid cells still have replicated chromosomes, too much DNA for one cell. So they need to go through another round that's just like mitosis, which we call meiosis II, to split those chromatids apart. Therefore, what lines up during metaphase II of meiosis is really the same thing that lines up during metaphase of mitosis. Namely, individual replicated chromosomes. That's all the cell has left. It doesn't have any homologs, right? It doesn't make sense to keep using the word homolog after meiosis I, because the other homolog is in a totally different cell at that point, right? So within that individual cell, you don't have homologous chromosomes anymore. It's a haploid cell. There's only one of each of the N kinds. So the individual replicated chromosomes line up, and then in anaphase, the sister chromatids split apart. And when all this goes well, since it's two rounds of division, you end up with four different cells. And that's how gametes are formed in our body, whether it's eggs coming from germline cells in the ovary or sperm coming from germline cells in testes. Okay? These gametes are the things, those haploid cells that can get together in the next round of fertilization sexual life cycle continues. Right? That's going to produce another diploid zygote, a new individual, and then this continues. It's going to be back and forth between fertilization and meiosis. Now, on slide 7, we see a picture that's really similar to the one we looked at for mitosis. Especially in the names, as I've said here, of the subphases. The big difference is that there's two rounds of division. So you have meiosis 1 and meiosis 2. But make sense of these pictures. Compare them. I don't have the other one right here, but when you look back through your slideshows, compare what's happening in this cartoon to what's happening in the mitosis cartoon. In prophase 1, in other words, prophase of meiosis 1, the important thing that's happening is that the important thing that's different from mitosis, I should say, because the condensing of the chromatin into chromosomes is happening just like it is for mitosis and so on. But for meiosis, the thing that's happening that's different from mitosis in prophase 1 is that the two homologs find each other. They do not do that in mitosis, right? They're acting independently. So the two number 1s, the two number 2s, through the two number N's, whatever that is, find each other. And they not only find each other, they come together in a process called synapsis. That's the noun that refers to the process. If you want it, the verb is to synapse. To come together is to synapse, which is why we call the places where neurons come together synapses. Okay, so synapsis occurs in prophase 1. Not only do they synapse, which is, by the way, the synapsis is the process that actually forms the tetrad, right? Because not until they come together do you actually have a homologous pair that are connected together. That's the tetrad. But not only do they synapse, they also swap part of their chromosomes with each other in a process that we call crossing over. And you can see that if you look closely enough at your own version, I probably won't see it from there. I'll show you a better picture of crossing over later. But crossing over is a good name for it because a sister chromatid from one homolog and one of the sister chromatids from the other homolog, notice that those two are not sisters of each other. They're non-sister chromatids, right? One from 1A and one from 1B. They're not genetically identical, right? They come from different parents. They actually cross over at some point, physically cross over. That crossover point is called a chiasma. That's the singular. The plural of that is chiasmata, add a TA to the end. But it's not only that they physically cross over, which really wouldn't change anything genetically, but after that chiasma is formed, that crossover point, then the legs downstream of that, the part of my fingers that I'm wiggling here, get traded for each other. So this part of the red one will become this blue part, and vice versa. And notice that that means now all of a sudden you have a brand new sequence of DNA. You have chromosome that has never existed before. Because it's partly the father's chromosome in that blue one and a little bit of the mother's chromosome in that same blue one. And the other one is mostly mother's and partly father's. Neither one of those chromosomes is exactly like either parent. It's a brand new chromosome. And that's what sex accomplishes. New versions of DNA sequences. Okay? This is why offspring have different traits from their parents. Okay, so that's the other big thing that happens in prophase one. You have synapsis and crossing over. Probably not going to have time to get to through. Well, I definitely won't have time to get through this whole slide. But so, let me end with saying that crossing over is just one of three major ways, three processes that sex drastically amplifies the genetic variation. So I'll list those three now, but I'll have to explain the others later. And I'll list them in the order that they happen. Crossing over, I just told you. The second thing is independent assortment, which also happens in meiosis, and specifically meiosis one, but it happens after crossing over. So two of these three things I'm telling you about happen in meiosis. The third is random fertilization, okay, which I'll also explain later. Now, the very last thing I want to say is that, and make sense of this based on what I said crossing over, is none of this would matter at all, sex that is, wouldn't matter at all. It wouldn't change any of the genetic. It wouldn't add any genetic variation at all unless there were different versions of DNA to begin with. In other words, unless there was already genetic variation, because all this does is analogous to shuffling a deck of cards, right? So if you can imagine a deck of cards that is nothing but three of diamonds, you can shuffle them as long as you want to take, and every hand is going to be three of diamonds, right? So only if there are different cards to begin with will shuffling make any difference. Similarly, sex would not make any difference if it weren't the case that there's already genetic variation out there. What is the original source of all the genetic variation that we see? What is it that causes there to be different versions of DNA to begin with, which then sex can shuffle? Mutation. Exactly. which is totally random, accidental process, right? But that's what creates the new versions of DNA sequences. Once you have that, then sex can shuffle the deck and make the variation much, much greater. Okay.